door. It was locked. Thank God. I walked back to my car. At least I could say I'd tried. But something in my gut wasn't right. Something in me knew that trying wasn't enough. So I turned back and circled around the church. There they were, farther back, the telltale signs. Lit basement windows, a brick propping open the door, the stranger in a camo jacket ashing his cigarette outside. During that meeting, as others were speaking, I tried to figure out how to spin my drinking so I could leave the meeting and eventually drink again. Instead, I raised my hand and said exactly what I was thinking. I'm trying to figure out how to spin my drinking so I can eventually do it again. When I opened my mouth to speak, it was like a valve releasing a toxic, pressurized gas. After the meeting, a young woman, maybe 20 years old, with a shiny curtain of blonde hair, skinny jeans and heels, straight from some sorority pledge class, came up to me and started crying. "I can't stop trying to convince myself that I don't have to be here," she told me, "even though I need to be here." I was about to tell her that she should talk to someone better at sobriety, someone who hadn't just spent 3 weeks avoiding meetings. But then I realized she'd come up to me because I'd just announced that I'd spent 3 weeks avoiding meetings. She connected to that part of me and to the part of me that had come back anyway. We were both in that room for a reason. She said she'd never gotten drunk in the mornings until she heard someone in a meeting confess that he used to get drunk in the mornings. "That's fucked up, right?" she asked me. It seemed like half of her wanted me to tell her she was beyond hope, and half of her wanted me to tell her there was hope for her. But maybe she was just a Quinnipiac sorority girl who drank too much. And who was I to tell her anything? That's when she pulled up her bubblegum pink baby tee to show me her colostomy bag, a beige pouch tucked against the salon-tanned concavity of her abdomen. "I'm making myself sick," she said. "Nothing, before or since, has dissolved my self-absorption faster than the sight of that colostomy bag." She told me she knew she was supposed to drink less now that she had it, but she couldn't moderate. She'd just changed what she drank. No more beer, since it bloated the bag. Looking down at the ground, mumbling, she asked if she could have my number. I said of course she could, though it seemed absurd to think that I could help her. "And you, you ridiculous people, you expect me to help you." It turned out I needed her help, too. A few weeks after my first meeting in New Haven, I started reading David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest. I'd been surprised to hear it was a novel about recovery because I'd always thought of it as ego-inflated, a blue brick of a book by a smart guy who'd wanted to buoy his ego by writing it, beloved by other smart guys who'd wanted to buoy their egos by reading it. But once I started reading Infinite Jest, it seemed like much more than virtuosity for its own sake. The core of the book, for me at least, was Ennett House Alcohol and Drug Recovery House, where a massive and genuinely decent man named Don Gately is recovering from his dilaudid addiction and helping other people get better, one day at a time. The novel seemed self-aware about the trite sheen of these slogans, their simplicity and handled polish, but unapologetically committed to their messages anyway. Infinite Jest wasn't just about recovery, of course. It was also about a tennis academy right up the hill from Ennett House, and three brothers living there, a punter, a prodigy, and a stunted and complexly deformed boy, barely taller than a fire hydrant, all grieving a father who'd stuck his head in a microwave. It was also about the lethal film their father had made before he died, and the Quebecois separatist wheelchair assassins hell-bent on finding the film and deploying it as a weapon. This film was the engine at the center of the whole story, so engrossing that no one who watched it wanted to do anything but watch it forever. That's how it killed you. I approached my reading like a recovery program, by reading 50 pages a day, showing up for them whether I wanted to or not. At the top of each page, I took note of what had happened. He is weeping from desperation, but detached even from his own weeping. Or, Millicent makes a move. Or, Lyle licks the sweat. These notes were a way of taking my own attendance, a way of saying, I've been here. It wasn't that Infinite Jest took me back to meetings. It was the persistent desire to drink that took me back to meetings. But Infinite Jest helped me understand why I needed them. More specifically, it helped me understand that certain things about meetings could drive me crazy and I could still need them. The novel had metabolized recovery with so much rigor, it had already asked all of my questions and weathered all my intellectual discomforts. It documented what it called the grudging move toward maybe acknowledging that this unromantic, unhip, cliched AA thing, so unlikely and unpromising, this goofy, slapdash, anarchic system of low-rent gatherings and corny slogans and saccharine grins and hideous coffee, might actually offer something. In its simplicity and its slogans, in its church basement coffee and its effusion of anonymous and unqualified love. The novel offered an encounter with recovery charged by double consciousness, both interrogating and affirming it, investigating its labor, its oddness, and its sublimity. The novel was questioning the recitations of recovery, but still alive to its miracles, and not afraid to say so. Recovery is hope in Infinite Jest, but it's also absurd. It's grown men crawling across cheap carpeting with teddy bears tucked into the crooks of their arms. It's guys killing alley cats to get a sense of resolution. It's old-timer crocodiles and their emphysema-addled voices of prophecy. It's the soul-swollen, heartbroken, chain-smoking world of Boston AA in all its unromantic, unhip wonder. Serious AAs look like these weird combinations of Gandhi and Mr. Rogers, the novel observes, with tattoos and enlarged livers and no teeth. Infinite Jest gets at something truthful and astonishing about how all of these people gather together seeming so humble, kind, helpful, tactful, how they actually are these things. Not because anyone is forcing them, but simply because it's the way they survive. The novel conjures the strange foods of recovery. Meatloaf covered in cornflakes, pasta doused with cream of something soup, ordinary things I'd also eaten, in the company of other ordinary people and their ordinary drinking memories. If I'd read The Lost Weekend, rooting for Don Burnham to get drunk again, I read Infinite Jest, rooting for Don Gately to stay sober. I was grateful to direct my narrative desires toward recovery rather than relapse, glad to know it was possible for a book to make me thrill toward wellness. If Berryman had imagined recovery as 12-step work, then I was 12-stepped by Wallace. The novel was my old-timer just when I needed one. Gately describes the newly sober as so desperate to escape their own interior that they want to lay responsibility for themselves at the feet of something as seductive and consuming as their former friend, the substance. I wanted to lay myself at the feet of the book that told me that. Wallace himself went to a Boston rehab called Granada House in late 1989, 7 years before Infinite Jest was published. "It's a rough crowd," he wrote to a friend. "Sometimes I'm scared or feel superior or both." Years later, he described his experiences at Granada House in an anonymous online testimonial. "They listened because, in the last analysis, they really understood me. They had been on the fence of both wanting to get sober and not, of loving the very thing that was killing you, of being able to imagine life neither with drugs and alcohol nor without them. They also recognized bullshit and manipulation and meaningless intellectualization as a way of evading terrible truths. And on many days, the most helpful thing they did was to laugh at me and make fun of my dodges, which were, I realize now, pathetically easy for a fellow addict to spot, and to advise me just not to use chemicals today because tomorrow might very well look different. Advice like this sounds too simplistic to be helpful, but it was crucial. In his biography of Wallace, D.T. Max argues that he quickly understood the ways that recovery was also a literary opportunity. Wallace was learning a new world. He was glimpsing hundreds of exposed interior lives. He kept a list called Heard in Meetings that still remains in his archives, written on ordinary yellow-lined paper. The happiness of being among people, just a person among people. They say it's good for the soul, but I don't feel nothing inside you could call a soul. I shit myself every day for years. I came in to save my ass and found my soul was attached. No is also an answer to my prayers as well. It hurts. But recovery was far from just a source of material for Wallace. Max argues recovery was part of his growing commitment to single entendre writing, writing that meant what it said. Recovery shifted Wallace's whole notion of what writing could do, what purpose it might serve, made him want to dramatize the saving alchemy of community, the transformative force of outward-facing attention, the possibilities of simplicity as an alternative to the clever alibis of complexity, meaningless intellectualization as a way of evading terrible truths. In Infinite Jest, Wallace describes irony and recovery as oil and water. An ironist in a Boston AA meeting is a witch in church. The novel believes in the sincere wisdom an ironist might scoff at, the kind you might find on a tear-off calendar or a daily prayer book. It doesn't believe in bromides as revelations, but it believes in what they seek, the possibility of common ground. After Hurricane Irene, our first August back in New Haven, the world was raw and wet and dazed. The Occupy movement filled Zuccotti Park, and then our own downtown green, a cluster of tarps and tents that sheltered protesters alongside people who had already been homeless. Years before, I might have dismissed a movement without a clear agenda as something without purpose. But collectivity itself had started to seem purposeful. The construction of a horizontal society right there on the grass, behind the downtown churches that held our meetings in their basements. Dave and I lived in a brick loft whose walls were literally crumbling, leaving little piles of brick dust in the corners. From a huge circular window in our living room, we could see the old converted corset factory where we'd gotten drunk that night Peter first found out about us, back when our love still felt reckless and destined, an animal with an incontestable will of its own. In this current chapter of our love, 3 years later, in which I was sober and we were struggling to find our pulse, we had friends over to a breakfast for dinner party one night. Eggs scrambled with melted ribbons of cheese, bacon and fried potatoes that filled the apartment with salty humidity. We ate syrup-soggy pancakes while dusk fell over the smokestacks by the railroad tracks. Other people drank mimosas, and I drank orange juice, and it was okay. Though it was an okay where I still had to remind myself, this is okay. While we were washing dishes at the end of the night, I went into the bathroom and willed myself to remember that a year before I would have been yelling at Dave right now, or fuming, or flinching at his touch, and I wasn't. But it didn't make everything right. After everyone left, on that night and others, I watched Dave physically drain out, almost like he was deflating. We could still put on the show of ourselves for other people, but on our own we were becoming shells. There was something tender and forced about our jokes, saturated with effort. I'd been sober 9 months, and I was going to meetings 5 times a week, sometimes 7. After that first New Haven meeting, I'd flung myself into them fully, and I'd also started working with a new sponsor, Susan, a lawyer in her 60s who wore big, chunky beaded necklaces and drank her lattes with a straw. The first time I ever heard her speak, she talked about packing a Magnum bottle of wine to take with her to rehab. That made more sense to me than someone saying, "You never have to drink again." It made me think of the calligraphy poster in Infinite Jest, hanging in the Ennett House bathroom. Everything I've ever let go of had claw marks on it. Susan was warm and sarcastic and real about what hurt. She held me accountable to every rule I wanted to be an exception to. She had ended her marriage just a few months after getting back from rehab, which program wisdom didn't recommend. You were supposed to wait a year before you made any big life choices. But Susan's divorce had also opened up the next era of her life, a move away from the Connecticut suburb where she'd lived for decades, to a downtown studio with a piano in the corner and gauzy afternoon light. She drove women to meetings 4 or 5 days a week. Sobriety had granted her enough clarity to see that the life she'd spent decades creating wasn't the one she wanted to stay inside of, which was a gift, but not a gift anyone wants. I didn't think I was living Susan's story, the story of sobriety as a rupture, but I was oddly compelled by it, the idea that happiness might look like the end of love, rather than its repair. During that first year of recovery, I felt so liberated from one type of dependence, that bodily thirst, that I started to push back against the idea of dependence itself. It was hard to distinguish between the kinds of desire that might compose me and those that would diminish me. In many ways, AA was all about embracing need, resisting self-sufficiency, seeking humility, granting help and receiving it. But as I grew comfortable inside the system of validated need AA provided, I grew less comfortable with the more diffuse, nebulous, cluttered needs that defined my relationship with Dave. With him, I started to cauterize every need like an open wound. I stopped asking him for anything. Meetings were easier than love because there was a simple pattern. Do X, do Y, do Z. You knew you were doing what you were supposed to. Love was more like, do X, or else do Y, hope for Z, and pray something works, and maybe it will, and probably it won't. Many evenings I was away from our apartment, at AA meetings or with my sponsor, and often left in the morning, sometimes before Dave woke, to walk to an early meeting downtown. On a Saturday afternoon Dave suggested we spend together, I told him I was going to an apple orchard with two girls from the program, and I could see a flicker of hurt or disappointment. There was beauty in my life that day. Wind-rustled apple trees, soft soil, the mush of fallen fruit. But it was a beauty I inhabited without him. I never imagined he'd feel excluded, though. Only thought he'd be relieved I wanted less. That fall, I lived in a different version of New Haven than I'd lived in the first time around. This new version of the city was less cloistered by the university, more populated by everyone who lived beyond its borders. At meetings, I ended up in homeless shelters and retirement homes, swapping numbers with women after they'd gotten their court order slips signed. I was moving between the worlds of graduate school and recovery, straddling the powerful rifts between their conflicting imperatives. Think harder. Don't overthink it. Say something new. You can't say anything new. Interrogate simplicity. Keep it simple. Be loved because you're smart. Be loved because you are. My dissertation was reckoning with a question I hoped might bridge these worlds, examining authors who'd tried to get sober and exploring how recovery had become part of their creative lives. It wasn't criticism as autobiography exactly, so much as speculative autobiography, trying to find a map for what my own sober creativity might look like. Once a week, I led an undergraduate discussion section for a lecture course on Faulkner, Fitzgerald, and Hemingway, the old, mythic drunks. In one of our classes, we talked about Babylon Revisited, Fitzgerald's short story about an alcoholic named Charlie who comes back to Paris, the city where he used to live, where his wife died, and finds that he can no longer stand his old life of debauchery. He just wants to become a better father. At the end of the story, he loses custody of his daughter, but manages to limit himself to just one drink. I asked my students if they thought the story reached any resolution. Would things turn around for Charlie? I knew this wasn't how we were supposed to teach. Acting as if Charlie was a real guy, someone I'd met at a meeting, say, and we were just speculating about his fate. Acting as if he were another number on a narco farm intake slip. Prognosis guarded. But I was seeking company in pretty much every story I encountered. So I asked my students if they thought Charlie would ever manage to stay sober, and kept calling on people until finally someone said, yes, he thought he would. I don't want to sound melodramatic here, Raymond Carver wrote to his editor Gordon Lish in 1980, protesting a drastic round of edits. But I've come back from the grave to start writing stories once more. By the grave, Carver meant the drinking that had almost killed him. And by stories, he meant the stories in What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, the ones he'd been writing since getting sober in 1977. Lish's radical edits threatened Carver's faith in his newfound sober creativity from many directions at once. I'm serious, Carver wrote, insisting the stories were intimately hooked up with my getting well, recovering, gaining back some little self-esteem and feeling of worth as a writer and a human being. Although Carver's early sobriety stories were full of desperation, they were also shot through with unexpected veins of hope and surprising moments of connection, the residue of recovery. But Lish had always been attracted to Carver's bleakness. When Lish edited the early sobriety stories, it wasn't just that he explicitly downplayed references to drinking and AA. He also pushed back against what he understood as the lurking threat of sentimentality, places where he felt the prose reaching for too much sappy affinity or ham-handed redemption. Carver's original versions, written during the days when he was first finding respite in AA's community of strangers, often landed on moments when strangers connected in odd or surprising ways, feeding each other, identifying with each other, praying for each other. But Lish's edited endings usually landed on moments of disdain or unintentional cruelty instead, strangers resenting or abusing each other. Poet Tess Gallagher, Carver's partner at the time, recalled, I remember Ray's bafflement at one particular suggestion, that he remove all the references to drinking from the stories. I remember responding that his editor must not realize what Ray had been through, that he had nearly died from alcoholism, and that alcohol was practically a character in the stories. This was to be Ray's first book since he had become sober. He was telling the truth about physical and emotional damage and what it was like to come back from the dead. Near the end of his drinking, Carver hadn't been anything like the rogue I'd once imagined. He was bloated and overweight. He lived like a hermit, and often called his students to cancel class because he was too sick to teach. When he invited three of them to dinner one night, they ate hamburger helper and shared a single fork. When he came back to Iowa City to give a reading before his first book came out, it should have been like the return of a conquering hero, but he was so drunk the audience could barely understand a word he said. This wasn't reckless debauchery or existential knowledge plucked from the dark maw of some universal psychic void. This was just a human body pushed to the edge of its own poisoning. Carver finally stopped drinking on June 2, 1977. If you want the truth, he said in one interview, I'm prouder of that I've quit drinking, than I am of anything in my life. The stories Carver wrote in early sobriety weren't just full of the chaos of drinking, but also the possibilities of recovery. They were full of guys who'd drunk too much and were trying to patch things up with their wives, full of gin ghosts and AA commitments, full of guys learning to fish and to pray, a sober man sneaking out of his house in the middle of the night to kill slugs, a sober man lying about knowing famous astronauts, a drunk man stealing his estranged wife's holiday pies, One man listens to his wife remembering how he carried her to the bathroom when she was pregnant. No one else could ever love me in that way, that much, she says, while he obsesses about the half pint of whiskey hidden under her couch cushion. I began to hope she might soon have to get up. These sobriety stories carry the pulse of the booze not just in the obvious places, in the whiskey shots and the morning doses of champagne and the clever one-liners about drinking. Booze takes a lot of time and effort if you're going to do a good job with it. But in those quiet moments when characters have fallen away from each other and don't know how to come together again, these silences are the hollow spaces that booze wants to fill. When Carver first saw Lish's revisions, not just whittled, but spiritually rearranged, he couldn't stomach the thought of their publication. At this point, the two men had known each other for nearly a decade. Lish had given Carver his big break when he acquired one of his stories for Esquire in 1971, and he'd been editing him ever since. This time, he'd removed more than half his prose, and under the guise of renovating Carver's style, he smuggled in a different vision of human nature, less prone to care, concern, and empathetic imagination, and more inclined to rupture, resentment, and disconnect. In his 1981 review of the collection, critic Michael Wood lamented the unkindness and condescension of some of these stories, the same stories about which Carver had written to Lish, "I don't want to lose track, lose touch with the little human connections." It's not clear why Carver allowed his stories to be published with the edits he resisted so vehemently, but it's quite possible his consent was a product of the same fragility that had made him worry about the edits in the first place. He was eager for the affirmation of a book, hated the idea of disappointing anyone, and wanted to believe in the future of his sober writing. But the book that came into the world wasn't the same book Carver had written. In the story eventually published as The Bath, the most famous in the collection, a story Lish cut to less than a third of its original length, a boy named Scotty is struck by a car on the morning of his birthday. While he's lying in a coma in the hospital, his parents start getting calls from a menacing stranger who turns out to be the baker who made Scotty's birthday cake, growing increasingly irritated that nobody ever came to pick it up. When the boy's mother picks up the phone, asking, utterly desperate, if it's someone calling with news of her son, the baker says, "It is about Scotty. It has to do with Scotty. Yes." In Lish's version, the story ends on that baker's yes, his voice over the phone, that closing beat of irony and unwitting brutality. We don't find out if the boy lives or dies. This version of the story is about senseless tragedy and the human fissures it illuminates, about the ways distance can verge into malice. But Carver's original version, A Small, Good Thing, eventually published years later, doesn't close with the phone call. Scotty's parents end up visiting the baker in his shop and explaining their loss. In this version, their son has died. After they tell him what happened, the baker feeds them warm cinnamon rolls just out of the oven, the icing still runny, and a loaf of fresh, dark bread, telling them about his own weary days. They listened to him. They ate what they could. They swallowed the dark bread. It was like daylight under the fluorescent trays of light. The baker offers the minor solace of tangible pleasure, the kind of small, good thing my own days in a hot Iowa kitchen had taught me something about. And this broken bread ultimately catalyzes another type of communion. They talked on into the early morning, the high, pale cast of light in the windows, and they did not think of leaving. Carver's original ending offers neither utter despair nor unequivocal redemption. It's more like chiaroscuro, light and dark. The parents are granted temporary respite from their grief, and the baker isn't entirely defined by callousness. The couple's son is gone, but the world isn't an utterly irredeemable and indifferent place. However small its doses, Grace comes with stealth and arrives from unexpected corners. Incomplete. Imperfect. Important. In the story Lish called After the Denim, an elderly sober man finds himself enraged by a young hippie couple he spots cheating at bingo. Underneath this rage, he's in anguish over the return of his wife's cancer, and the story ends with his grief expressed as anger, with the man picking up his needlework and stabbing at the eye with a length of blue silk thread. But the original version of the story, which Carver had called If It Please You, ends not with anger, a man stabbing at his needlework, powerless to change fate, furious with those whom fate has treated better, but with the unexplicable alchemy of anger turning into something more forgiving. He and the hippie were in the same boat, the old man thinks, and senses something stir inside him again. But it was not anger this time. The story closes with this something stirring. This time he was able to include the girl and the hippie in his prayers. Let them have it, yes, drive vans and be arrogant and laugh and wear rings, even cheat if they wanted. Meanwhile, prayers were needed. They could use them too, even his, especially his, in fact. If it please you, he said in the new prayers for all of them, the living and the dead. This act of prayer, not simply praying for a stranger, but for a stranger he loathes, is actually a specific part of AA teaching. If you have a resentment you want to be free of, if you will pray for the person or thing that you resent, you will be free. Lish's edits may have been fighting prose Lish understood as sentimental, but if sentimentality indulges in false emotion that turns away from the world, the wet eyes of the sentimentalist betray his aversion to experience, his arid heart, as James Baldwin put it, then Carver never turns away from the complexity of experience. The old man's prayer is an ending that allows for multiple layers of emotion, grace alongside fury, rather than settling into a simpler and more predictable vein of unmediated disdain. Carver's solace is vexed and hard won, but his endings have faith in the communion of dark bread, in small, good things exchanged in the deep night. A few years after this fraught round of edits, Carver insisted to Lish that his next story collection couldn't go through the same process. Gordon, God's truth, and I may as well say it out now, I can't undergo the kind of surgical amputation and transplant that might make them some way fit into the carton so the lid will close. There may have to be limbs and heads of hair sticking out. My heart won't take it otherwise. It will simply burst, and I mean that. Carver was willing to risk melodrama. It will simply burst. To stand behind the writing of his recovery. Writing that was messier, full of grit and swell, ragged intimacies and inexplicable attachments. He wanted to stand behind stories that didn't end on irony. Stories awkward and grasping enough to hold the longings of sobriety, with its strange permissions and unexpected bonds. That first fall back in New Haven, I started going to a meeting downtown at 7:30 every morning. Walking on Chapel Street just past 7, during early winter when it stayed dark late, took me through the quieter city that got swallowed up each morning once the familiar one awoke. Lights flicked into sharp fluorescence at the tire shop. Commuter trains deposited plaid-scarfed businessmen on the State Street platform. The dollar store showed a window full of kids' backpacks and discount rolling suitcases through its chainmetal grating. The 7:30 meeting was held in a stately stone building downtown. About half its crowd had come straight from one of the city's homeless shelters, which asked clients to leave at 7. Some people came for the meeting, and others came for the coffee, bitter and scalding, served with a handful of creamers on a table in the back. And many probably came for both. It wasn't always clear what someone had come for, and it was probably rarely only one thing anyway. The meeting was full of old-timers, some sober for decades, who sustained a fierce and opaque ecosystem of ancient feuds and intimacies. An elderly black man named Theo was the unofficial spiritual leader of the group. You could tell he'd been through a lot of shit, but he wasn't putting it in your face, and he showed up every morning, just like he'd showed up every morning for decades. At that meeting, I was painfully aware of how much I had and how much I hadn't lost. I was wary of how anything I shared might come across to others in the room, people who were struggling with so much more. The woman fighting for custody of her kids, the guy who'd been in and out of shelters for almost a year, but had finally gotten a job at a pizza parlor in town. How could comparing my addiction to theirs seem like anything but a misunderstanding of what they'd suffered? I didn't want to suggest, "I've been through that too," with my very presence, when of course I hadn't. My story was contoured by desire more than loss. But I was surprised by the ways other people sought commonality, and at a certain point I realized I was the one projecting difference by assuming others felt it. Believing in what we shared didn't have to make me blind to what we didn't. Resonance wasn't the same thing as conflation. It didn't mean pretending we'd all lived the same thing. It just meant listening. People had gotten punched in the face for different reasons, but drinking had made all our bodies vulnerable. We weren't there to assume or insist on perfect correspondence. We were there to open ourselves to the possibility of company. I liked how often people at that meeting said, "I just can't get a fucking break." How often they got angry at other people, at their own lives. One day a man stood up and shouted at another man across the room, "When are you going to give me back that $20? The guy called back, "Why don't you go suck someone for $20? It was liberating to hear voices break from the sacrosanct script of chanting the steps, from the promises of the preamble, a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem. And also, honestly, so they could get something straight about money that was owed, or how so-and-so was fucking wrong. People were putting their lives back together after many losses and many relapses. Desire and regret still glowed fiercely in that room, still hot to the touch. Infinite Jest is honest about the weirdness of depersonalized goodwill in recovery. What it feels like to be loved indiscriminately, not for your qualities but just schnamm, because. The book understands the discomfort of hearing the program promise, "Let us love you until you learn to love yourself," and the aggressive insistence of being hugged by strangers. After a meeting, one character asks a stranger, "You gonna risk vulnerability and discomfort and hug my ass? Or do I gonna fucking rip your head off and shit down your neck?" Don Gately was unlike any literary hero I'd ever encountered. A sober felon with a big square head, his meaty tattooed hands often carrying the cakes he bakes for other people's sobriety birthdays. In meetings, he talks about fucking up in sobriety, and he gets irritated at sober drunks all the time. When someone complains too much, he uses his pinky finger to mime the world's smallest viola playing the theme from The Sorrow and the Pity. Gately's no saint. That's why he made salvation seem possible. That's what I loved about sobriety in the book. It wasn't stolid or pedantic. It was palpable and crackling and absurd. It was so brutally alive on every page. After Gately protects an asshole rehab resident in a gunfight and ends up getting shot, he spends his hospital days refusing morphine. No one single instant of it was unendurable, he thinks. What was undealable with was the thought of all the instants all lined up and stretching ahead, glittering. It reminded me of how I'd imagined sobriety. One dull evening after another, a mountain of dried up tea bags, no single night impossible, their infinite horizon unthinkable. We're all drama queens, even in our sobriety. My dry nights were gunshot wounds. But even when Gately is enduring emergency-type pain, like scream and yank your charred hand off the stove-type pain. He still spends most of his time, somewhat grudgingly, listening to other people unload their woes. Gately wanted to tell Tiny Yule that he could totally fucking ID with Yule's feelings, and that if he, Tiny, could just hang in and tote that bale and put one little well-shined shoe in front of the other, everything would end up all right. In the hospital, Gately becomes a huge, mute confessional booth, like Luther holding court at Seneca, silent and smoking at the kitchen table while everyone else talked. Infinite Jest was full of people like me, people who were trying to outsmart recovery but still sought affirmation from its rituals. Like one businessman in a Boston AA meeting who has the sort of professional background where he's used to trying to impress gatherings of persons. Lying in his hospital bed, Gately imagines himself standing at a lavish commitment podium, like an AA convention, offhandedly saying something that got an enormous laugh. Gately isn't taking morphine, sure, but he's also fantasizing about how he'll tell the story of that heroism in a meeting someday. Gately shared my desperate desire to get the loudest applause, to tell a story that wouldn't make a man call out, "This is boring," ever again. The book could totally fucking ID with the ways my ego intruded on my recovery. It knew the ordinariness of that intrusion. It understood my wariness about recovery culture. It got my embarrassment and my worship. It showed me that my disdain for unoriginal cliches was entirely unoriginal. It gave me hope because its hope was so unvarnished. I read Infinite Jest like a desperate old man running his metal detector over the sand, waiting for every ding that signified buried wisdom, even though I worried that Wallace was too smart to be read with this type of greed. I felt indicted by critics like Christian Lorentzen, who wrote disdainfully of readers who look to novels and novelists for instruction on how to lead their lives, who were drawn to Wallace's bromides about brains beating like hearts, literature as a salve for loneliness, and novels comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable, etc. But I was bromide dependent. The most important things I'd ever endured or believed probably lived in Lorentzen's etc., covering their faces in shame. I read Wallace with my psychic highlighter always at the ready. Perhaps that made me simplify him as I sucked on lozenges of truth. Sometimes human beings have to just sit in one place and, like, hurt. But his novel had gotten me through plenty of moments of just sitting there and, like, hurting. It pursued what Berryman called wisdom work. In my PhD program, other grad students talked about their undergraduate students with fond condescension, how they were always looking for the moral of the story or the lesson to learn. But fuck that easy dismissal. Fuck that charge of reduction and that snickering at bromides. Because sometimes I just needed to sit there and remember that Infinite Jest said sometimes I just needed to sit there and, like, hurt. Sometimes I needed the single entendre truth. Sometimes I needed the cherry blossoms, the abundant meat aisle, the cold sunlight, the new life. Too simple, Wallace wrote in the margin of one of his self-help books, or just that simple. I'd been so afraid of sobriety as a flat line, as Jackson had been afraid of sobriety as a flat line, as Berryman and Stephen King and Dennis Johnson and the older waitress sitting at the Tuesday morning meeting had been afraid of sobriety as a flat line. I'd been afraid that meetings were basically lobotomies served alongside coffee-flavored water and Chips Ahoy, afraid that even if sobriety could offer stability and sincerity and maybe even salvation, it could never be a story. But Infinite Jest knew better. It wasn't that the novel's brilliance had survived the deadening force of sobriety. Its brilliance depended on what sobriety had wrought. On his first sobriety birthday, Wallace received a copy of a 1987 play called Bill W. and Dr. Bob, as a gift from his sponsor. The cover was inscribed, "To David, congratulations on year one," and featured an illustration that suggested fellowship. Two men in suits, their faces out of frame, one holding a mug of coffee with a wisp of steam curling out of it. Wallace marked only one passage, a piece of dialogue. Dr. Bob, inching his chair closer. "If I don't drink, I'm a monster. I need it to function, to be a doctor, husband, father. Without it, I'm so afraid I can't function at all. Booze is the glue holding me together, the one thing I can count on." Next to that, Wallace wrote just three words: "How I feel." It's easy to feel good about resonance. It's actually quite addictive, the nodding rhythm of communion. "Yes, I know how you feel." This presumed empathy tastes righteous and expansive on the tongue. During my early days of sobriety, I started seeing resonance everywhere, like a primary color I'd never noticed. One afternoon, I sat at an oak desk tucked in the silent hallways of the library and noticed what a stranger had carved in the wood. "I am a virgin." Then others had written around that, "Me too, so am I, so am I, so am I." But the flip side of communion's humility, being willing to say, "I'm not the only one," is the danger of assumption or conflation. "I've felt what you've felt." It's so satisfying to acknowledge what's shared that it can become its own temptation to insist on commonality everywhere. Partway through his book about working with Skid Row addicts, clinician Gabor Maté brings himself into the frame. "Hello, my name is Gabor, and I am a compulsive classical music shopper." After the portraits that have come before, crack and heroin addicts who are homeless or turning tricks, losing limbs to infections at their injection sites, Maté's confession reads at first like a joke, then like a provocation, asking us to accept a continuity he suspects we will initially resist. Describing the thousands of dollars he has compulsively spent on classical music, the way he plays it loud to drown out his family, Maté acknowledges that his addiction wears dainty white gloves. But he also insists on a single addiction process that manifests across a continuum of behaviors. The frantic self-soothing of overeaters or shopaholics, the obsessions of gamblers, sexaholics, and compulsive internet users, or the socially acceptable and even admired behaviors of the workaholic. It's what Eve Kosofsky-Sedgwick calls addiction attribution, the ways we try to understand everything as addiction. Shopping, email, even exercise, the mascot of willpower. Addiction attribution can become an addiction in its own right. The satisfaction of an expansive rubric offers its own intoxication. We're all in this together. If addiction is a continuum, then we all get to live on its axis somewhere, blasting Beethoven to drown out the voices of our children, or gorging on chocolate after we get fired. But I'm wary of attributing addiction so broadly it ceases to mean anything besides compulsively desiring something capable of causing harm. I don't want to ignore the particular physical mechanisms of addiction by mining it too easily for universal truths. We all crave. We all compensate. We all seek relief. Because we don't all seek in the same ways, and the seeking doesn't always punish the seeker. It's important to acknowledge the specific damage wrought by certain cravings, what they can do to a brain, what they can do to a life. When the American Psychiatric Association released the fifth edition of its Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders in 2013, and officially changed its definition of substance use disorder from a category to a spectrum, many scientists were afraid that its broadened criteria for addiction would effectively produce too many addicts, that it would, in essence, make everyone who had ever drunk recklessly an addict, and destroy a vital distinction between dysfunction and disease. What do I think? That it's important not to lose our grip on the notion of disease or its physical mechanisms by defining it too broadly. But it's also true that everyone has longed for something that harms her. I wish we could invoke that universality, not to render the boundaries of addiction utterly porous, but to humanize those under its thrall. When I asked my own diary, drunk, am I an alcoholic? I was trying to answer a question about desire. When does ordinary craving become pathology? Now I think, when it becomes tyrannical enough to summon shame, when it stops constituting the self and begins to construe it as lack, when you want to stop and can't and try again and can't and try again and can't. It is not till many fixes pass that your desire is need, George Kane wrote. It was what I'd been born for, waiting for all my life. When I asked my own diary, drunk, am I an alcoholic? I was looking for a category that might tell me whether my pain was real, as if drinking would make it incontestable. Of course my pain was real, just like everyone's. Of course it wasn't quite like anyone's, just like everyone's. As culprit and cause, drinking offered a convenient vessel for certain difficulties I found harder to pin down precisely. When I was first getting sober, I wrote myself a story about my relationship with Dave in which I was the source of our troubles, my insecurity and distrust, and booze was the source of my troubles. And so, by getting rid of the booze, I'd start to fix them. But we were less broken than that, or more broken than that, and back in New Haven, an odd, eerie quiet settled over our joint life. Days in libraries, stew bubbling in the slow cooker, old coffee grounds in the French press, then the trash can. This calm didn't feel like relief from fighting. It was more distant than that. In some strange, corrosive way, our fights had been intimate and binding, toxic but saturating, impossible to turn away from. Fighting meant we were both fully present. Back in New Haven, we were kinder with each other, gentler, but also robotic somehow. When we came back home to each other at the end of the day, it was as if we were both reaching for bodies that weren't quite there. That fall, we went to another wedding, our 10th or 12th or 100th, who could count, and pitched our tent in a meadow. The wedding was full of people who had been in various a cappella groups with the groom, and every so often a cluster of strangers would break into song beside me, like a spontaneous brush fire. I promise to enjoy spirituality with you, the bride told the groom during their vows. I promise to enjoy nature with you, he replied. That night it rained until dawn, and I woke up tangled in a corner of our tent, muddy ground slippery beneath the thin vinyl floor, my body fully out of our sleeping bag, as if I'd been trying to roll as far away from Dave as possible. He took a photo of me that morning, standing in my long underwear outside the tent, with the meadow and hills behind. And once the photo had been glossed with the right cell phone filter, it made our campsite look like a magical elfin land. Gorgeous, said everyone on Facebook. But I knew I'd actually been irritated and tired, dispirited by the happiness of others. The night before, the reception had been a supra, a traditional Georgian feast that revolved around an elaborate and dizzyingly comprehensive series of toasts. To God, to the dead, to the living, to our tents, with the bride and groom drinking red wine from a silver-lipped, animal-furred drinking horn. With each new round of toasts, a different stranger looked at me and frowned. Don't you know, one finally said, it's horrible luck to toast with water. Back home, I'd started to smell something strange in our bedroom, a barn smell, like soggy hay or damp fur, something wet and animal. The prior tenants had told us they'd had a squirrel infestation, and I wondered if they were still nesting behind our brick walls, their little burrows soaked with urine and packed with nuts, squirming with hairless babies, helpless, grotesque creatures wriggling all around us. When we started spotting mice, it was almost a relief. There was something wrong, and we would get rid of it. We set up snap traps under our cupboards and smeared them carefully with gobs of peanut butter. At first, the mice managed to steal the peanut butter without setting them off, licking the yellow plastic paddles absolutely clean, like tiny superheroes with one specially honed skill. I sat on the couch and watched one mouse move so gracefully, with so little weight on its claws and such a barely present tongue, that it managed to get everything it wanted without dying. We set up glue traps next, and woke in the night to hear one mouse squealing as he struggled, still horribly, painfully alive. We lay beside each other, listening. It was impossible to sleep. Finally, Dave got up and smacked the mouse against the floor. A mercy kill. The apartment grew quiet again. When I confessed to Susan that I'd begun to fantasize about breaking up with Dave, just imagining what it might be like, she reminded me that the program suggested against making any major changes in the first year of sobriety, and that included ending a relationship. I wanted to say, you ended yours. She had an apartment of her own, a life alone that seemed, somehow, deeply generative. In recovery meetings, I was surrounded by the stories of people who were living in the clean, empty aftermaths of new beginnings, leaving old relationships, old homes, old cities, and beginning again at rehab, in meetings, with the steps. In truth, plenty of people were simply getting sober inside the lives they'd always lived, with the same jobs, the same marriages, the same children. But I kept seeing the story of rebirth because it was the story I wanted to see. People who were starting again, who were lonely and free. When I looked at Dave, I felt exhausted, as if our relationship was a messy room I had to clean up. Part of me craved the relief of a clean beginning, a pure loss, then rebuilding on my own. Seneca House compelled me because it had been the threshold of a new beginning for thousands of addicts, or at least its promise. I wanted to see the place for myself. But by the time I visited Seneca Creek in 2015, the house itself was just a ghost, a bare patch of grassy land tucked between the water and the woods. The building had been torn down after the rehab shut its doors in 1992, after an unsuccessful merger with a larger treatment center. I'd driven out with Sawyer the lawyer, who now suffered from a degenerative muscle disease that kept him largely immobilized, so we'd taken a special van outfitted to accommodate his wheelchair. Over the phone, Sawyer had referred to the disease as his affliction in a wry tone that suggested scare quotes. After decades spent in a community whose currency was shared pain, Sawyer knew the various tones in which suffering could be articulated. He knew what it sounded like when people milked their lives for drama, and he was choosing another tone of voice. Matter of fact, calling out the temptation to dramatize rather than indulging it. He also had cancer in his prostate and in one of his ribs. These maladies were mentioned as afterthoughts. When I visited Sawyer at his home in Maryland, just a half hour from Seneca Creek, it was a July day so hot and bright it threatened to close his morning glories by noon. His fridge was cluttered with the faces of his grandkids, a granddaughter's carefully typed babysitting ad. I am serious and dependable. Getting Sawyer settled in his van required two motorized wheelchairs, a walker, and one motorized chairlift. I secured his motorized wheelchair to the interior of his van with four straps, harnessed to latches on the floor, and, terrified he'd come unstuck, drove at a steady 20 miles per hour, my sweaty palms locked on the steering wheel. From the back of the van, Sawyer pointed out the old Clabbered General store down the road from Seneca, built and opened in 1901, where Seneca guests had walked to buy the cigarettes they weren't supposed to smoke indoors. He pointed out the golf course that the guests had walked across during Hurricane Agnes to stay in a cheap hotel when the house itself flooded. Back at home, Sawyer hadn't wanted to give me his drunk log, the stories of Chinatown rot gut and his kids eating by candlelight. He'd wanted to talk instead about self-improvement.